Hello, Andrew here. I just wanted to let you know that this episode includes some discussion on the topics of suicide and physical abuse. If this episode is not for you, then I hope that you'll join us for the next one. And if you're staying, then please listen considerately. Okay, on with the episode. Hello, and welcome to the Family Histories Podcast, the show for and about those of us who are sat quietly in libraries, archives, and spare rooms all around the world, tirelessly piecing together our collective social and family history. My name is Andrew Martin. I'm a family historian, and I'll be your host. In this episode, The Cousin, we'll be hearing about a woman whose memories of a life surrounded by trauma have helped my guest to write a book. And we're on the trail of some missing 20th century Andersons, known to have lived in Minnesota, USA. So, put down that old codicil, grab a cuppa, and let's meet our guest. My guest today spent more than 30 years working in journalism, and his work has not only led to being a multi-nominee for a Pulitzer Prize, but his work won a Pulitzer Prize for national reporting in 1998. Of course, he has also turned his truth-seeking skills to researching his family history, culminating in his book, When Mortals Play God. So, before he goes and sniffs out another story to break, I should introduce my guest, John Erickson. Hello, John. Welcome to the Family Histories Podcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
It's a pleasure. I've never met a Pulitzer Prize winner before.
Okay.
Do you want to perhaps tell us a little bit about what it was that led you to winning that?
Well, it was I worked for a medium-sized newspaper, the Dayton Daily News in Dayton, Ohio, we were a small paper, but we did a lot of big stories, and one of them was on the military medical system, and its kind of shoddy performance. So we pursued that for about a year, finally got it into print, and it resulted in actually some changes. They made some changes as a result of the story.
Wow. That's great. Do you think that your research for that article and for that story led you on to your interest in family history, or did you already have one before then?
You know, I kind of got onto family history by accident.
Okay.
It came about because my mother-in-law wanted me to find her father. And she had never met her father. And so I pretty much on the side just did some research on that. And he had died by that time, but two of his sons were alive. And so I got their phone numbers and gave them to my mother-in-law. And sure, she called them and actually developed a relationship with them. And so I was talking to my mother one day and I told her about this story. And she said, well, you know, maybe you can find my little brother.
Oh.
I said, your little brother, you know, she had never told me that she had a younger brother. I knew she had an older brother, but she had never told me she had a younger brother. So I went off to find him, and it was quite difficult. She had very little information. She knew they were in an orphanage at one time, did not know the name of the orphanage.
Okay.
So it was a lot of trial and error. And finally, it was I just sort of luck that I came upon the name of the orphanage. And I called them up. They were long since closed, but I called up the place that had taken residence there.
Right.
And asked them if they were indeed in the same building. And they said, yes, we are. I said, can I come and visit? They said, sure. They kind of warned against high expectations and said, there isn't much here from when you were there. Okay. And so I thought, well, you know, I'll just bring my mom there. She was only there for a short time, and it was she was there in 1928.
Okay.
And this was 2015. And so anyway, brought her up there, not expecting much. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe it'll just be kind of cool for her to walk the halls, you know. And
okay, yeah.
And so we got there, and the administrator said, well, I found some things you might want to look at. And she had gone into the basement of the place and dug out all these records from when my mother and her two brothers were in the orphanage.
Wow.
And gave us as much time as we needed to go through them. They were, you know, it was a Catholic orphanage, so it was, they were very detailed records. It gave the names of the two people who adopted her younger brother. And so,
wow.
Yeah, it was an amazing find. And so I went off trying to find them. And so that was another difficult journey because their last name was Anderson, which is very common. So
yes.
So, but I did find some things. And so anyway, you know, my journalism background was very helpful because I think what it tells you is persistence and you know, turning over rocks and just trying things. And so I just kept turning over rocks and finally, you know, I got enough material that I thought I had a book.
Wow. What kind of records did they find? I mean, that's quite remarkable that they had still got them there and by chance that they'd still got the records that were relevant to your research there and that they let you look at them.
Right, right.
What kind of things did they have there?
Well, it was everything from the height, weight, the time they got there, what time they got there, what time they left, what kind of testing was done. They were quite detailed, really. But the amazing thing was that, you know, getting their adoptive parents, because I couldn't have found that anywhere else. No. Adoption records are sealed for like 100 years. So, you know, I couldn't have got it. You know, it was the only way I got it. And this, you know, this administrator, I think she kind of was intrigued by the story. This woman who had been there, you know, had lived there for, you know, almost 100 years ago and was still alive. And so I think she went down into their basement and dug out these records. And, you know, she was very careful not to let me look at other people's records. But, you know, she allowed me to look at my mom and her two brothers. And we snapped probably 50 or more photos of the records, you know, because they were in these big, huge books that, of course, you couldn't photocopy. We just took photos.
Wow. And so once you'd got that information about the adoptive parents, you know, how did you go about finding them or tracking them down?
Well, a lot of it was like online resources. The father's name was Raymond Anderson. And of course, there's a million of those out there. But I knew that they lived in this small town called Eveleth, Minnesota. And so I tracked down Raymond Anderson, Eveleth, and eventually found out that they had moved to Chicago. And, you know, I used census records and you know, some other records and got a sort of a sense of how long he was there. They had lived in Chicago for a while. Then they came back to Minnesota, and then they went back to Chicago. And Robert, my uncle, I think he spent most of his time in Minnesota. So I spent a lot of time trying to find him and trying to find his kids, which I never did find. But I was able to find a half-sister who knew him. She was much younger. See, Raymond and his wife, Santa Anderson, they adopted three children.
Okay.
But they were they adopted Robert, my uncle, in 1928. They adopted a second child in 1932. And then they adopted a third child in, I think, 1940 or somewhere along. It might have even been later than that. She was the one she was still alive at the time. She's since passed. And she had COPD and could barely breathe, but she was willing to talk to me. But she didn't really know him that well because she was a lot younger than he was. But, you know, his death record said that he had done some military service, Another, an obituary for his adoptive mother said that he was the survivors included two grandchildren with that had his name, last name. So I tried to find them, was not able to find them, but I did find when I went back to the death certificate,
right,
and it was filled out. There was a lot of information about him, including what, you know, his occupation was, and
okay.
And so I looked at the bottom. At first, I thought maybe this was just a doctor who had filled it out. But I looked at the bottom, and it gave the name of this woman who had filled out all this information. And so I thought, well, maybe she's like a family member. So I tried to find her, and unfortunately, she had died. But her obituary had her son. And so I called him up, and turns out he knew Robert. He knew my uncle.
Okay.
And it was the first time I'd run across anybody who had known him. And so I was I was asking if he had any photos, you know, because the only photo I had was of Robert when he was like 3 years old. And he said he didn't have any photos. So I had him describe him for me. And this was kind of funny too, is I decided to take my mom to his gravesite, Robert's gravesite, because he had died in like 19. You know, my whole dream with this is to reunite,
you know,
my mom with her long lost brother. And unfortunately, I was not able to do that because he had died. But I decided, well, what's the next best thing? Let's bring her to the gravesite. So anyway, I called the cemetery.
Okay.
And, you know, I told him what I wanted to do. And the curator said, yeah, sure. You know, you can come on out. And I said, just out of curiosity, do you have, and I gave him the name of the woman who had filled out the death certificate. And he said, oh, yeah, she's right next to him. So I knew then that she was probably his girlfriend.
Yeah.
And her son kind of confirmed that for me. So anyway, that's one of the unexpected discoveries that happens when you turn over a lot of rocks.
Certainly does. Have you ever dabbled with DNA testing at all?
A little. I didn't have much luck with that.
Oh.
You know, I did the saliva sample and sent that in, and every now and again, and I'll get contacted by a second or third cousin, and I've put out some queries to people, but in this particular case, it did not help me.
What do you think you've learned about yourself whilst researching this?
Well, the book is really kind of about how eugenics really almost destroyed, you know, families. And there are a lot of books about eugenics, but I don't know of anyone that really got into the, you know, personal side of it and how it impacted families. And you know, for your listeners, part of the story here is my grandmother was sent to she was kind of kicked out of school when she was really only 8 years old. This was in 1920s in a railroad town in rural Minnesota, and they didn't really have an infrastructure for people with any kind of learning disabilities. And so she was basically cast aside and put on the street. And she got into some trouble. When she became a teenager, she also became a prostitute. That's pretty clear. And so anyway, she was declared to be immoral and was sent away to an institution more than 100 miles from her home.
Yeah.
And this is what they did back then. They sent people who were said to be feeble-minded into this institution. And her three children were taken from her. They were placed in an orphanage. One was adopted out. That was Robert. He was never heard from by anybody in the family again. Her oldest son stayed in that orphanage for 2 years. And part of my reporting showed that the orphanage was the scene of priests sexually abusing kids at that orphanage. So, you know, I wasn't able to find if that happened to Ernie. I'm not sure I even wanted to find out. But clearly it wasn't a great experience for him. He had a troubled life, a lot of broken marriages and relationships, including with his own kids. And he ended up shooting up a courtroom in Portland, Oregon in 1979. So the real question here is, did he shoot up in a courtroom in Portland, Oregon in 1979 because his mother was institutionalized 50 years before? Well, you know, of course you can't make that connection, but, you know, childhood experiences matter. And it was pretty clear he had a pretty rough childhood, as did my own mother. Now she came out of it okay. And that happens to some people. They're able to survive and thrive under really difficult circumstances. And that was the case with her, but it wasn't so much the case with him. And it actually gets worse because his own son, 17 years later, tried to blow up a couple of restaurants packed with people on a Sunday morning. So anyway, a lot of bad things happened. How much of it was due to eugenics that, you know, nobody could ever say, but it was not a good thing for my family. Right. And I think that's true of a lot of families. In fact, the state of Minnesota even issued an apology to families about 15 years ago that, you know, they sort of acknowledged the horrible treatment that was done to families in the name of eugenics. So what did I, you know, what did I learn about this? I learned that, you know, my family went through a lot of trauma that I really didn't know existed. And personally, I think it's good to know that stuff. You know, I think I came out all right, and, you know, everybody else in my family did. But it was a tough thing, no question about it.
Yeah. Do you think that if you know where you've come from, it gives you a firmer footing and you're going forward in your life as well?
Well, you know, Rose, my grandmother, she was an alcoholic in addition to, you know, she was really kind of a bad mother, at least to my mother, and wasn't really a warm person. So you don't want to be that kind of person. You know, you want to be somebody that people want to be around. So, you know, I think she had a lot of good quality. I think in doing this research, I developed some empathy for her, because really she was treated terribly. And she ended up, you know, she was released, she was institutionalized three times, but she got out for good in 1930 and she lived another 30 years. You know, it wasn't the kind of life, I suppose, that these eugenicists thought people should live, but she lived it on her terms, and there's something to be said for that, I think.
Sure. At what point did you think all of this that I've researched should become a book, or did you kind of stumble into writing a book?
Kind of the stumble part. At first, I just wanted to find my uncle. You know, that was sort of the task. And but then I found all this stuff about my grandmother. And I think my wife at one point said, you know, she's the story. And I think she was right about that, because it all kind of stemmed from what happened to her. You know, if she hadn't had her three children taken away from her, there would have been no adoption. And as I point out in the book, you know, adoption's a wonderful thing and has saved the lives of a lot of people. But when he was taken away, my mother never saw or heard from him again, never even knew what had happened to him. And that was the same with Ernie. And maybe they would have benefited, you know, from having known their brother.
Yeah.
But that wasn't an option that was made available to them.
Life can lead us in all directions. So it's inevitable that while you research your family history, you're going to stumble across at least one interesting story. With this in mind, it's now time for my guest to share the life story of one of their most fascinatingly good, bad, or just plain ugly relatives. So, John, who are you going to introduce us to?
I think I'll introduce you to my cousin, who is Ernie, my uncle's daughter, Carolyn.
Is that McLean?
Yeah. This is somebody who I've developed a great deal of respect for and actually gotten to know pretty well.
Okay.
I barely knew her when this started. I mean, I knew I had a cousin named Carolyn, but I didn't know anything about her. And she was very helpful to me throughout this whole thing. And,
okay.
And she is this kind of bubbly personality, and it kind of shows that, you know, we're survivors. And, you know, her father kind of, you know, he divorced her mother, got married a couple other times, and was not the greatest father in the world. You know, he apparently at one time was fairly well off, but, you know, would not pay child support. And she said they had heat, but they didn't have a lot of other things in their home. And she sort of grew up under that situation with a single mom. And then her brother was a really troubled person. He ended up trying to blow up a pair of restaurants. But prior to that, he terrorized the family, and he terrorized her.
Okay.
And he terrorized her mother. And he ended up dying.
Oh.
He tried to blow up a couple of restaurants, and then he killed himself, which was almost 17 years to the day after his father had shot up a courtroom in Portland, Oregon, and then put a gun to his head. She also had a sister who was lost at sea when she was 20 years old. And a lot of people think that resulted in what happened in the courtroom. And so, you know, she lost a sister. Her father committed suicide. Her brother, you know, did terrible things and then basically committed suicide.
Wow.
She is the most lovely person you'd ever meet. It was just really rewarding, I guess, to be able to get to know her a little bit.
I bet. I was not expecting all of that. I imagine that she must have had a lot of stories to tell you, having gone through all of that.
She did. And, you know, as you do family histories, I think one of the things you learn is that you have to, you know, use your strengths. And one of my strengths was that I knew how to find information for the most part, but also I was able to get people to trust who they were talking to, because I was a family member. So I got to know her and she got to know me, and that worked to my advantage in terms of getting information for the book, but also, you know, that's a lifelong friendship that I wouldn't have otherwise. And, you know, I the fact that I was a family member was also, I was able to talk to Ernie's ex-wife.
Right.
She was the one who he pointed a gun at in the courtroom. So, and fired, he missed her, but he fired. And so, she told me she had spent her lifetime trying to forget what happened that day, yet she talked to me. And the only reason she would do that is that, you know, I was a member of the family. So as you're doing family histories, there are a lot of things you have to overcome, but one of the things you can use to your advantage is the fact that you are gathering information about a family member.
So you said that he killed himself almost on the 17th anniversary?
It was very close to that. And, you know, he was about to go back to prison. He had a drug charge on his head. There was some things going on with him. He was just a bad guy. You know, I mean, there's no two ways about it. And, you know, when Ernie killed himself in the courtroom, his son Michael leaned over and said, "Don't worry, we'll get him." I asked his wife Billy, who she thought he was talking about with "we'll get him," and she said, "Well, he was talking about me." So,
wow. So
I don't know if it was time to that. I think it was probably time to the fact that he was, you know, in a bad way and about to go back to prison, didn't want to do that. And so he wanted to go out with a bang. And he did.
Wow. And how did your cousin feel about casting her memory back to all of these things and telling these stories? I mean, you said that you were obviously a relative, so maybe that's easier, but it must have been quite difficult.
Yeah, I think it was, but I think sometimes it's therapeutic to talk about things. Yeah. And I think part of it is just her personality. And you know, she told me some really deeply personal things, and I let her know what I was using and what I wasn't using. But, you know, part, you know, some people want to bury things and never talk about them, and that just isn't who she is. And yeah, I couldn't have gotten nearly as much as I got just without talking to her. She told me all kinds of little stories of her and her siblings and her father and her mother. And yeah, you know, I'm quite grateful to her for sharing that with me.
And how do you process and deal with all of this that's part of your family history? You seem quite a cool, calm, collected kind of guy. how do you cope with it?
Well, you know, my journalism background probably helped in that regard. Okay. You know, as a journalist, you're often delving into people's histories, and a lot of times it isn't very pleasant. And so I think I was used to doing that. But, you know, I think it might have been hard on some of my family members. My brother called me up after the book came out, and he was I had actually shared quite a lot of it with him, but he learned some new things. And, okay. And you know, there were some really troubling things. You know, there's a scene in the book where my grandmother took off with her own mother's husband and with her three children. And, wow. Yeah. And, you know, and they were actually pulled over in International Falls, Minnesota, which is about 200 miles from their home and near the Canadian border. And, you know, where were they going? You know, I mean, who knows? And that landed her back in the institution. And you know, that's another thing is, did she do something that was that an offense that should have put her back in prison? You know, one of the things I found with this is that I'm not even sure she was, even to use the word of the day, feeble-minded. She was uneducated. She was poor. And that's basically all it took to get you declared feeble-minded.
Yeah.
I was able to look at some letters that she had written to her son when he was in prison, and they were very well, you know, well thought out and did not strike me as something from a feeble-minded individual. So, you know, maybe she didn't write them. I don't know. But I do know that they put a lot of people in those institutions that some of them were like blind, and they landed in the institution and were declared feeble-minded. Which if you think about it, you know, Ray Charles and Stevie Wonder would be declared feeble-minded under that kind of practice. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
So it was a horrible, horrible thing that happened to a lot of families. And, I thought it was important to show that there was a personal toll from this that didn't just end when my grandmother was put in an institution and sterilized. It actually had legs, and not all of them were good.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, John, for sharing this life story. But I think it's time for you to face
the brick wall.
Those dead ends in our research are called brick walls, where the trail of clues go cold. They can be excruciatingly annoying, and they can block you finding your ancestors for, well, sometimes forever. In this part of the show, my guest is going to share one of his brick walls in a hope that one of you, dear listeners, might just have a clue or a research idea that helps him make a breakthrough. Right, John, what have you got for us?
Well, the biggest brick wall was I was not able to find two things, actually. Okay. I was not able to find my uncle's military records,
okay,
because they burned up in a fire in, I think it was 1979 or something like that. And the second one was I really tried to find his two children. The reason I know he had two children is in the obituary for his mother, they were listed by name. One was Patricia, I believe, and the other was Robert. And so I tried marriage records. I tried divorce records. I tried birth records. I was not able to find them. And I tried different states. In the end, I had to make a decision. Do I go on without them? And that's what I ended up doing. So yeah, that was definitely my brick wall.
Okay. What would Patricia and Robert's last name be?
Unfortunately, Anderson.
Okay.
So,
That would be the brick wall, wouldn't it?
Yeah. And Patricia I assume she married at some point and had a different name. And
sure.
For a long time, I wasn't even 100% sure that, Robert's adoptive father was named Raymond, because in the record I got from the orphanage, it was handwritten, and Ray could have easily been Roy.
Okay.
Yeah, I even took out a magnifying glass, you know, to try to make sure that I had it right. And in the end, I did have it right.
Right.
So anyway, the Anderson name is very common. It was definitely a roadblock. You know, I was really amazed, actually, that I got as much as I did on them. But not getting the children was a disappointing, to say the least.
Do you know approximately when Patricia and Robert may have been born?
I don't. And the reason I don't is because his death record said that he was a military veteran.
Okay.
And he was born in 1925. You know, the war ended in 1945. Mm-hmm. So it's likely he served when he was 19 or so. So it would have most likely been after that. So it would have probably been sometime after 1945, 1946, something like that.
And I guess you don't know the state or town where that would have taken place.
No, I don't. I know that he returned to Minnesota at some point. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it could have been in the 80s, could have been before then. It was interesting in the obituaries for his father, who I don't have the date in front of me, but I think he died in the 80s sometime. And he did not mention his son, Robert. So, you know, he might have been estranged from the family.
Yeah.
His adoptive sister did tell me that he was an alcoholic, which didn't really surprise me because, you know, his mother was. And also I confirmed that through his love interest son, who said that, you know, there were bottles all over the apartment, and he would disappear for, you know, weeks, and then he'd come back, and he said the alcoholism took its toll on him.
Yeah.
So anyway, he might be estranged from his kids too for that reason.
Yeah, possibly. So let's imagine that you had access to a time machine and you could go back in time to find the answer to this for yourself. When do you think you would choose?
Probably in the 40s, you know, because I would like to find out, you know, what happened to him after the war.
Okay.
And again, as I mentioned, just reuniting him with my mother, that was really my goal all along. And that would have, in tracing his history, I was able to find that, you know, at different times he lived only a couple of miles away from my mother.
Oh.
So That's just, if I could go back then and find out, drop in on his house and talk to him and say, hey, your sister lives just a few blocks from here, that would have been pretty cool.
And where do you know whereabouts kind of exactly he was during that time, or just kind of roughly?
Well, I did, because his father came back to Minnesota during the 40s, mid-40s, I think. Okay. And I looked at city directories from that time, and I was able to get his address, and it listed who was living with him. And so Robert was living with his father at the time. And, well, actually both his parents. So at least at some point in the 40s, he was living not far from where my mother was living at the time.
That's great. Well, if our listeners have an idea on how to help you with this, they can, of course, go to our website, which is familyhistoriespodcast.com, where they can read the show notes for this episode. And if they want to use the contact form to send some clues that might just help to nudge this along a little bit for you and help solve this brick wall, then of course, we will forward that on to you, John, and my fingers are crossed here. They can also email us at hello@familyhistoriespodcast.com, and we'll pass that on. And hopefully we can untangle these Andersons and get some answers for you.
That would be great.
Now, whilst the listeners go looking for clues, I might just be able to help you solve this, that you're going to need to follow me through to the garage. Well, here we are.
Okay, but what is it?
This is my secret time machine, and that's Shandor Paterfi.
This can't be real.
No, I am real.
I think he meant the time machine, Shandor. Anyway, they are both real, and as a kind of thank you, I thought you might like a return trip back in time to help solve your brick wall.
If only that were possible.
Ah, but it is. If you sit over there, yeah, that's it, then I'll set the temporal coordinates to try June the 1st, 1946 in Minneapolis, Minnesota, USA.
Well, I'm not convinced this will work, but okay, sure.
Right, well, let me just fine-tune this.
Watch out! There's the sound again.
Yeah, I heard it this time.
What does he say?
Let me just...
What's going on?
Nothing.
Right, John, you'll need this. It's a temporal beacon. Keep it with you at all times and press the big button on the top when you're ready to come back.
Is this safe?
Oh, yes, yeah, 100%. Usually? Well, I haven't lost anyone yet. Now, we're all set. Here we go. John Erickson. Thank you, goodbye, and good luck. Oh, spot on.
I fixed it. Again.
Well, thank goodness you did. Now, what is that noise? The Family Histories podcast was presented and produced by me, Andrew Martin. My guest was the brilliant John Erickson, with John Spike as Shandor Paterfi. If you've enjoyed this episode, then don't forget to click subscribe to get the next one for free. Thank you for listening. Approximately no family historians were harmed in the making of this podcast.